You've fallen down the rock and roll rabbit hole.
All right, welcome back to the Rock and Roll Rabbit Hole.
That's right, I'm Kevin Gibson.
And I'm Butch Bays.
And we are happy to do this yet again.
I'm super happy to do this every time.
You picked this song, so I know that you're really happy about doing this. But yeah, we're gonna do a song that that is sort of a redemption song in a way. Maybe not a redemption song, but I don't know. But we're doing. Tell us the song.
It represents a mighty comeback. It's Back in Black from 1980 by the Thunder from Down Under, AC/DC.
Yeah.
Just a song that's kind of echoed through radios ever since. I don't think this song ever goes offline,
does it? It's been used in movies and TV shows.
Very much so.
It's one of those enduring songs that everyone knows. I mean, if you don't know this song, then you've been living on another planet.
It's kind of interesting to punch a song into like the real mainstream where it's just never going to go away. Or and appears to never going to.
Yeah, and it's a song that like... It's like the first time I heard it, I'm like, what the heck is he talking about? But it's just such a great song.
It had a dark feel. You knew something was going on.
It had like 9 guitar solos. I mean, so it's just, it's just one of those songs that just stuck with me from when I was a teenager, you know.
Oh, absolutely. It takes you right back there. So, all right, let's do the opening ceremonies tonight.
What we have today, Butch? You pick these up.
We've got a
Harvest Stone Old Engine Oil Black Ale. We chose a black ale for Back in Black.
We wanted to pair it with the old Back in Black. So,
Butch, I don't know, because you've never had this, right?
I have not had this.
I had this at a beer festival a number of years ago.
It's very mysterious and murky. None of the light in the room shines through this bottle. So.
It's going to be the same way in the glass. And we're going to
get... I just thought everything about old engine oil, black ale, all of it.
Let's pour this beautiful liquid into our glasses. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's just as dark as I remember. To light my
oh wow
black twisted soul. Oh, smell that.
Okay, let me get a
chocolate.
Wow, so this is made in Scotland, right? So
I believe chocolate. I'm getting some Scottish little bit of
to
coffee,
rock and roll fans
to rock and roll, to AC/DC, to black beers everywhere.
Absolutely. Not bad at all.
Nice creamy tan head. Yeah. Ooh, that's bitter. That's bitter like a cup of coffee on a hangover morning. I like it.
So it's a good kind of bitter, I guess.
Yes, it's bitter. It's bitter like me after living on this earth for 45 years.
All right, as we are known to do, I guess it's appropriate to go to the tail of the tape. Back in Black is a song by Australian rock band AC/DC. It was released as the fourth single from their 7th album of the same name in 1980. Through Atlantic Records. It's notable for its opening guitar riff, says here. So thanks to Wikipedia for that.
Yeah.
The song was written as a tribute to former lead singer Bon Scott, and we'll get into all that.
Yeah.
It reached number 37 on the Billboard Hot 100, and in 2012 it reached number 65 in Australia and number 27 in the United Kingdom again. So
which
maybe that was featured.
Proof
in the
of its longevity. Yeah.
Back in Black, the album went 25 times platinum.
Great.
50 millions of units sold. Okay. Third best all time, if you count the Eagles, greatest hits. But anyway, it's there were over 22 million sold in the U.S. alone. Prompting the saying, you can't swing an Eagles greatest hits around here without hitting a copy of Back in Black. I don't think that's a real saying.
It is now.
But anyway, it plays at the opening scene from the Iron Man film in 2008. And that kind of, it says it provides an aggressive intro into the Marvel Comic Universe movies. That brought it all back. They did a compilation album, I believe, that went with that, which was their first, AC/DC's first sort of greatest hits, which did great in the charts, too. It was featured in Grudge Match, The Muppets, Megamind.
The Muppets.
2010's Karate Kid.
School of Rock.
Yeah.
I remember it from School of Rock, man. Yeah. That's like a School of Rock song.
Is it not? Kind of defined that movie. So, Jack Black, Love Back in Black.
Back in Black. Yeah, why would he not?
Why would he not?
That's probably why he took that name. That can't be his real name, can't be.
Yeah, it's probably not. But
like Jack Smith or something.
It's conceivable that it would be.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
We'll have our research staff.
Maybe he changed his first name from, like, you know, Horatio. Maybe he was Horatio Black and now he's Jack Black.
Yeah, but, I think that's probably the one he changed.
Orlando.
Orlando. Oh, that's nice. All right. So I don't think it's proper to start off a discussion about the song. We're talking about the song.
Right.
You know.
And not death.
We're going to talk about death to talk about this song. So we're going to talk, of course, a little bit about the album, but. You have to give a little backstory on this, and I'm sure most people our age and most people that are inquisitive on this band know the story of Bon Scott, their original lead singer. Interestingly enough, the Young Brothers' parents moved them to Australia when they were about 8 and 10 years old. Bon Scott was also relocated to Australia from Scotland. They all came from Scotland.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a... somewhat of a Scottish band relocated to Australia and then back to England. When they moved to England, they recorded the Highway to Hell album with Mutt Lange. And that was their first taste of the real international kind of profile.
Yep.
Started to hit in America. Do you remember those days?
I do vaguely. I wasn't listening to a lot of rock and roll then. But my experience with AC/DC was being in high school. And there was a girl in one of my classes who wore an AC/DC shirt like 2 or 3 times a week and just talked about him constantly. And it was like, it was in the time, like, not long after Bon Scott had passed away.
Oh.
So I was just like, wow, this band must be really impactful. And then I listened to him. I was like, whoa, what the heck's that guy saying? You know, I mean, it was one of those things.
Yeah, and he sounded kind of like a devious guy, kind of like a little bit of a scary... devilish guy, right? And of course, he's singing Highway to Hell. But
right.
But they wrote the success.
Highway to Heck? Is this for a cleaner audience? I don't know. Highway to Heck.
Yeah, okay. But anyway.
Highway to Hades? I don't know.
They wrote the success of that album in the summer of 79. Yeah. Bon Scott got his teeth fixed. He was a very charismatic, impish, crazy kind of guy, right? Really fun guy, it seemed to be. But anyway, of course, he liked to party.
Yeah.
A lot. So February 19th of 1980, he went out to the pubs in London and spent the whole night out there. Well, I guess maybe the 18th, but spent the night drinking heavily. And a buddy locked him in a car to sober up, you know, probably as they had done times before. But this time he didn't wake up and he was... pronounced dead on arrival, and it was listed as death by misadventure. So I'd say that was a misadventure.
That was the ultimate misadventure.
Yeah, and Malcolm Young had to call his parents and tell them that's a grown-up thing to have to do there. And, you know, so that kind of sets us up on this time.
Yeah. So,
What do you know about what went on there?
And when, you know, the interesting thing there is that Bond's previous band had toured with Brian Johnson's previous band in 73.
Yeah, Geordie.
And so, Geordie. And which sounds so wholesome.
It does sound wholesome.
It sounds like a former Packers wide receiver. That's why I liked it. But, but he was like, you know, I guess he had told the band how good this guy was.
Yes.
And so they sort of knew him, and they offered the job to him, you know, and that's sort of kind of our jumping off point is that, you know, if they had offered it to someone else, who knows what happened. We'll get into that later. I'm not going to go there yet, but I've got some hypotheses.
Oh, do you? Well, it's quite interesting how Brian actually made his way down to audition for the band. They had known about him through Bon. Apparently, Mutt Lange, the famous producer, not so famous at this time, knew of Brian Johnson. And so they finally tracked him down. It wasn't like the days where you can send somebody an email. They had to finally call him.
You got to send a guy a letter and you know, hope that he gets it. I mean,
yeah. He was living with his parents flat broke. He says, I was skint.
And he was doing window fittings.
Yeah, and like windshield wipers, putting windshield wipers on cars, and like maybe like vinyl tops or something. Yeah. I don't
know. On cars.
Yep. He was a blue collar guy living with his parents after being divorced, apparently, or separated from his wife. And when he heard about this opportunity with AC/DC, he knew who the band was, but he wasn't all that excited to go because he felt like, you know, the music business had, you know, kind of done him wrong. He ended up broke, you know, from Jordy. Yeah. Actually had some songs in the top 50 or whatever. Yeah. But anyway.
Which is not uncommon. A lot of people feel spat out by the music industry, especially back then. So
very much
so. It's a whole other episode. But
the record company seems to always make the money, not the guys, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, he wasn't going to go to London to audition because he couldn't afford to go to London.
Right.
And a buddy got him a gig to sing for a Hoover vacuum cleaner commercial. And it was like this kind of rock and roll themed Hoover vacuum commercial. And that was going to be £350 pay in London. So that gave him the ability to come down to do that thing. And then he drove across town and he sat in a place. He says he had pie and the crust was too hard to even eat. And he had a coffee and a pie or something. And then he was kind of mulling over, do I walk across the street and go audition for this
wow,
this young band? He was older than them,
right?
And he felt washed up. He was 32 at this time, but he walks across the street, and the rest is history, man. Yeah. You know,
and thank goodness they chose him, because that's the thing, is that what I learned from that girl in high school and what I learned later was that AC/DC fans, the hardcore ones, are so hardcore that it's a miracle that they accepted him. But
that is an interesting point. Yes.
But when Back in Black came out, it was like, here we go. This is a new era, and it's for the most part, it wasn't like a previous show, like when Kiss did a disco song, there was a bigger split. And you know, and some AC/DC fans had a problem with it's
surely
not them without Bon Scott.
Surely they did.
You know,
yeah.
But I mean, it kept going because, and just based on my sort of bird's eye view of it, they never relinquished their status.
No,
to me,
and they they just went bigger.
Yeah,
somehow.
I'm not a huge fan. I always enjoyed them from afar.
Understood. You know,
but I just, they always were like, okay, this is a big band that's never going away. That was just my impression.
Oh,
you know, and here they still are, a big band that's never going away, getting in movies and, you know.
Sure. My thoughts on the subject, when Brian kind of came in and Back in Black came out, Highway to Hell was a song we had heard, but the band wasn't yet established in the way we know them now, where we basically can name, you know, all the members, whatever. We know everything about AC/DC. At the time, they were starting to become that thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just, I heard some comments that if they were bigger, it would have been harder to switch lead singers.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah. And that's, and exactly. And that's, and I made some notes about just some sort of what if scenarios. And they're kind of goofy, if you don't mind me.
No, let's go for it.
so how many times in rock history has this actually happened?
Well, I can only think of as far as a singer that passed away or a key member that passed away, usually it does a band in.
Right.
Van Halen's the only band I can remember switching lead singers and getting away with it very well.
And they got away with it and they were more successful, but the previous fans, a lot of them were like, ugh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and
there was a
I'm
big
one
split.
Of those.
Sure. Oh, well, there you go.
You know, I mean, so some of the notes I wrote was like, okay, so when Kurt Cobain died, Dave Grohl didn't say, let's get a new singer and keep playing as Nirvana. No, he started the Foo Fighters.
Right.
He said, this is over.
It was over.
Kurt's gone. That's it. It's gone. And that's okay. What about the Doors?
Yeah, the Doors were over.
Yeah, they were over.
You know, I think the Doors are a great that's a great analogy to the AC/DC situation, because Jim contributed a lot of lyrics, but he wasn't the whole show.
Aha, that's it.
Much like Bon Scott was
Angus Young is the sort of the equaling factor.
Yes.
He is. A lot of times when you look up an AC/DC picture, it's it's Brian and Angus.
Well, on the Highway to Hell album, on that album cover, they had a picture of the band, Angus in the middle with the devil horns. Yep. So he was very much the trademark of the band.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's part of why it worked. You know, so here's another weird one. Like, Jimi Hendrix's band didn't continue playing as the Experience.
No.
The Crickets.
Oh.
The Crickets performed for many years with a lot of different lead singers, but never with Buddy Holly's replacement in the band. It was always, right, we're going to do an album with Bobby V, we're going to do this, we're going to do that.
Yeah.
And so then...
Didn't make anybody wear thick glasses or...
Right. And so, near and dear to my heart, the Smithereens.
You know,
Smithereens are still touring,
right,
but with various lead singers. Robin Wilson, you know, so it's like...
Marshall Crenshaw.
Yeah. So they're not saying we're still the Smithereens that you know and we're trying to fool you. No, we're just touring because we love to play rock and roll.
Carrying on the legacy, more or less.
Right.
But you know, it's more of a coast in than an ascendance to this whole other level, right?
That's,
for some of these
right,
bands.
That's the thing. Sure. And so you could say, you know, like Journey employed a couple different lead singers.
Yes, they did.
But everyone knows that's not Steve Perry.
I agree.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of AC/DC fans that would go to a show if they played now, and not really necessarily notice the difference. And they would, if they were hardcore fans, of course they would say, "All right, this is the Brian Johnson era." But there are a lot that maybe just know the songs. I'm just going not notice.
Well, it is getting more and more that way. Yeah, I agree.
Because that explains a lot of the tribute bands that we've talked about with each other. We'll have to do a whole episode about tribute bands. But
sure.
I don't know. To me, it's just a remarkable sort of instance of where you could bring another guy in and, you know, you sort of didn't miss a beat.
It happened very quickly.
Yes. Well, the song came out, 5 months after Bond died?
5 or 6 months after Bond died,
so
they were back with
this
album.
And I interviewed a local singer who joined Foreigner after, what's his name, left?
Lou Gramm.
Lou Gramm left. And they were like, we're not going to miss a beat. We're going on tour. And this guy was
wrong answer.
Right. He was in a band called Buster Brown that was a regional hit.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And, of course, it fell on its face.
Sure.
You know, and so that's another story.
It's
that,
just
that
not easy to
me.
Do. Yeah.
And I can't remember. I interviewed him and became sort of short-term buddies with him, but I can't remember his name right now because I just didn't have this in my notes. I didn't look it up. But anyway, I get people, like, sometimes will email me and say, do you know where I can contact him? Because I found your article. I'm like, that was 25 years ago. I don't know where he is, you know. So anyway.
You got to keep track of these people.
I should do better.
Inquiring minds want to know. So here's my funny thought about the switchover and how quickly it took place. The boys, Malcolm and Angus, got the blessing from Bond's parents to carry on. They said that Bond would want you to carry this thing, you know, onward.
Rock and roll.
So they went ahead and started kind of rehearsing again and auditioning lead singers. But this all kind of happened so fast that I think some people wonder a little bit whether it's distasteful just a little bit to move that quickly. It's sort of like if your spouse died and you got married like 2 months later, you know.
Yeah. But, interesting, yeah.
But I feel like it's a case for fans, especially casual fans in the United States and probably, you know, mostly around the world, where Bond dies and they get Brian so quickly. It's like when a goldfish dies and the parents replace the goldfish with one that looks kind of, you know, pretty much similar,
right,
and hopes they don't notice.
And the kid's like, hey, that's not my fish.
No, they don't know.
My parents didn't know. My parents did that to me.
did they really?
Yep. I lived a sitcom.
Tell me about that briefly.
I went away for a weekend to spend a week, you know, weekend with a friend, and my fish died. And I came back, and there was the bowl, and I walked in. I'm like, where's my fish? Where's my goldfish? And they were like, what? What are you talking about? He's fine. I'm like, that's not my fish. That's a different fish.
So you knew?
I knew immediately.
But my premise is that the majority of the world didn't They
right. That's
if
what
they
saying.
Knew it was a different fish, it didn't.
Hardcore
it almost didn't
fans
matter.
Knew,
sure,
but the general public were like, you know, oh, all right, another great AC/DC album. Good.
Well, my impression now, looking back, I don't know how aware I was of the Highway to Hell era and the Bon Scott era. I sort of backtracked to that after I got into Back in Black and the subsequent material, you know, but. To me, it kind of had this feeling like the album honors Bon.
Album.
Yes. And this song, Back in Black, you know, right. I want to get into the lyrics a little bit about how it tribute, you know, is a tribute to Bon. But it's almost like if Bon came back from the dead as like a super version of himself. Because I think...
well, and one that didn't, you know, never died in a puddle of his own vomit. You know, that's another thing I'm going to get to later. But,
okay.
But
Brian's vocals were so much, like, so powerful and so, I mean, they just grab you. I'm not saying he's better than Bon, but it's like, it was obviously a step up in intensity, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it was sort of like, if this is a tribute, the cover's black. There was some discussion of having it be all black, but they ended up.
None more, you know, black?
None more
like
black.
Like this beer?
Exactly. But they ended up putting AC/DC on there, and then the title, of course, and kind of white, gray, silver. Well, I can't tell exactly what it is. But anyway, it is more like a Viking funeral than a somber memorial, would you say?
100%. And that's what they wanted. They wanted it, you know, and so some of the lyrics of the song... And it's funny, Brian wrote the lyric, they already had the riff, and they already had the title.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, and they were, because I think Angus had been playing that riff for a long time, just kind of warming up and stuff like that, and they finally were like, let's make this into a song that'll be a tribute to Bon.
But not a sad, morbid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're like, we don't want to do a ballad. We don't want to, you know, so... Brian wrote the lyrics, and he said that he thought they were kind of nonsensical.
So here's the new guy, right?
The new guy.
Yeah.
And they say, you write this, and he wrote it, and they loved it. They ate it up.
Yeah.
Because it had, like, the quote that I took was, forget the hearse, because I never die.
Right.
You know, and that was, like, the definitive thing to me was, like, okay, we're just carrying on something you helped start.
Yeah. You know, I got nine lives.
Let's not have a funeral. Yeah. And he abused all nine. And, you know,
right.
You know, and he did. In real life, he abused all of his lives.
I feel like the lyrics to the song Back in Black, I'm back in black, I hit the sack, all that stuff, it's been so long, I'm glad to be back. It sort of sounds like, in a way, resurrecting Bond's legacy, but also it also, especially the second verse, sort of tends to speak of more of the band, you know? Like, it's like, we're back and we're, you know, we're stronger than ever.
Right.
So I feel like they sort of paid tribute and then sort of turned the coin where they went a little more on to saying the band has resurrected from the dead, you know, or from a possible demise.
Right, exactly. That's the thing is that they were gaining in kind of popularity, and this was like almost a jumping off point. It was, you know, I'm sorry, unlike Van Hagar, which they did have more hits, it also soured people. I don't think that AC/DC really missed a beat. They just actually, it was like a jumping off point. I'm not saying that it was a good thing that Bon Scott died. And they
No.
But it became a different thing that maybe had more longevity. Going back to what I said, that, you know, I don't think Brian Johnson was ever going to die in the backseat of a car. You know, I think that the you know, Bon Scott was in the band for, what, 5 years, 5.5 years?
Yep.
And they released 6 strong albums.
Yes. They all sold well. Yeah.
And but Bon Scott's been in the band for, what, 35
or Brian,
years?
Brian
Johnson has been in the band for, what, 35 years now? 40 years?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so 40 years, I guess. Okay, so here's one of the nonsensical premises that
okay.
I came up
all
with
right,
today.
Okay, all right, nice. I'm ready.
So, timing is everything, as we know.
Yes.
We've talked about how you met your wife and how I met my fiance, if you will.
Sure.
So when this happened, Brian was working on Cars.
Broke.
You know, broke. It was, you know.
Dejected.
What if they had gotten Sammy Hagar to front AC/DC?
That's a, you know, he was probably available right at that time. It might have been around the end of Montrose.
Would it have been better for him to ruin Van Halen or AC/DC? I know it's ridiculous, but you know, what if they had tried to sign some star? So here's another one.
I'm going to say that's never crossed my mind, and as much as I obsess on rock and roll ever.
Good.
Yeah, all right.
What if they had got...
I need a moment. I need a moment. No, go ahead.
This is far-fetched. What if they had gotten Bruce Springsteen?
Wow.
He's got a gravelly voice. He sort of looks like Brian Johnson.
Yeah.
I think Brian Johnson looks like a cross between Springsteen and De Niro.
Oh, yeah.
Put that freaking newsboy hat on either one of them. And you know, you know
Bruce used to wear that hat in his career. He used to wear the driver.
Of that. Yeah, I forgot about that.
But I think that's pretty darn good. It's Springsteen and De Niro. Yeah, he is an exact mix between those two. But
yeah. So, I mean, it's like, what if they had chosen someone else? You know, and so I read this interesting debate on ultimateclassicrock.com. And so that's why I went down that rabbit hole.
Sure.
Did you find that when you were...
No, I don't know if I did or not. Yeah.
So it was just basically an argument. Bon Scott was better. Brian Johnson was better. You know, and so that's where I got to this writer. So the pro Bon Scott argument was... You know, their best albums, or at least there were more good albums prior to Brian Johnson than after. And he only had 5 years to write six.
Oh, like a better batting average.
Really, yes. So a better batting average. That's the perfect way to put it. Great analogy. So it was these two writers sort of traded off, and one was like, you know, I will trade you, you know, the two best Bon Scott albums, you know, or I'm sorry, I won't trade you for Back in Black, the Brian Johnson debut. He's like, I think it's better than the two best Bon Scott albums, and
I agree.
The longevity. And so that's the thing, and it, you know, that's what propelled them to that next level in a way.
Brings in an interesting point that I've come across a couple times. Now I don't know how much I entertain this thought. But Bon Scott was said to have a notebook. The band was already working on the Back in Black sessions. The writing, not the sessions, but the writing of Back in Black. And friends of Bon Scott said they saw some of the lyrics to You Shook Me All Night Long and some of these other things in Bon's notebook.
Yeah.
And so I would say the songs on Back in Black are not unlike some of them, not unlike what Bon would write.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, what I read was that like one of the producers said that he had that, but according to other sources, all that stuff was given to Scott's parents.
I'd heard that.
Yeah, that they so. Yeah, we'll never know. Unfortunately, I'm not going to debate that at all.
No, I don't think we have enough info to go.
Especially
with
as quickly as it was released after his death.
True.
You know, we don't know how. You know, there was a time when John Lennon kind of checked out of the Beatles because, you know, with Yoko and drug use.
Bon was definitely on a bender there. As evidenced by, you know, his end. But I don't think we have enough info to really say that was going on, that he actually had a lot of these lyrics written. But picture yourself
as... But we don't have the evidence that he didn't.
We don't, because picture yourself as a band... The Young Brothers, okay, and you had maybe some ideas going with Bon. If you say that Bon wrote part of the song, you give him credits, you got to give Bon's parents or heirs money for the rest of your life. I mean, you know, royalty checks. So maybe there's some motivation to hide that fact, but I just can't quite go there. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But it is intriguing.
here's a pop culture writer, Michael Gallucci, who's the editor at ultimateclassicrock.com, where I saw this. He wrote this. He wrote, he believed that without Back in Black, the album, AC/DC would have ended up more like the Scorpions in the history of rock.
Ooh.
And he said, and I quote, "Without that album, they most likely would have faded into the B-list of 70s and 80s rock bands."
Whoa. Interesting.
It's interesting. I mean, again, I'm not saying I agree or disagree. I was just fascinated by this concept that this guy who's been writing about pop culture and rock and roll for years has this view of it. And he was very convincing in his argument. It's worth looking up. Well, ultimateclassicrock.com.
Yeah, I'd love to read that. The way I see that analogy working pretty well, or that comparison, is that the Scorpions are somewhat, especially here in America, is like a sort of a cultish band now. And I feel like there would be sort of a cultish following for AC/DC, but it'd be like something that's kind of traded under the table. Sure. Where you hear people talk about
it. And I guess the difference being that, you know, Cynthia, my fiance, has a high school friend who is lead singer of a touring AC/DC tribute band called Thunderstruck.
Yes.
And they tour the world, you know, playing AC/DC songs, and we've seen them live together. And you know, and like
they do a fine job.
They do. I mean, it's so you don't. I don't see a whole lot of Scorpions tribute bands touring the world.
That's true. Well, you're talking about the third best-selling album of all times. Mm-hmm. You're talking it's approaches what the Eagles' greatest hits have sold, and you kind of know the power of that collection of songs. I mean, I heard someone say it's the number one rock album of all times, because I'm going to say Thriller, not necessarily rock. Eagles, not necessarily rock and roll. I mean, they have some, but, you know, that's a collection of sort of country rock, whatever. So this is the biggest metal, hard rock, you know, true rock and roll album of all times. So that can sweep a lot of stuff along with it, like tribute bands,
100%.
Illegal merchandise. I mean,
100%.
You know, all that stuff. It's so, just so powerful.
So that's the argument, is that, you know, would Bon Scott have been as productive if he was constantly drinking and constantly doing drugs and constantly, you know?
Well, that's the thing, I think there a lot of bands have that arc.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sort of like they start to make it and they start to decline. I want to ask you, though, as a not necessarily a big AC/DC guy.
Sure.
Not a huge fan, but I mean, I'm sure in some way it hits you right, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But why do you think Back in Black is the third best-selling album of all time and perhaps the number one rock album of all times? What is it in the stew that makes that happen?
Man, there's something raw and energetic about it that just screams, this is rock and roll, and we don't give a crap.
It's primitive.
It's primitive, yeah. I watched the video today for Back in Black.
Me too.
And that's why I made the joke that it was like 9 guitar solos. But like, I think there were 3, right? There's an outro, and I'm like, each one of these is so distinctively different.
They are tasteful.
That this 4.5 minute song becomes like an epic song without going over 6 minutes. I mean, it's like, it was just incredibly
like a
powerful.
Stairway to Heaven amount of power.
But it was not much more than any other pop song.
I had this thought about, you take like the Beatles, the Stones, and Led Zeppelin, you throw them in a pot on your stove and you start cooking it down. And you're cooking it down and you get it down and you taste it a little later. It's getting a little more on the Zeppelin side of things, you know, a little more simplified maybe. And then maybe you get a phone call or something for like a half hour, somebody you haven't talked to in a while, and you forget it's on the stove. And you go back and you scrape up this gnarly mess from the bottom, and it's like the most refined, baked down, cooked down version of rock and roll.
Wow.
Nothing extra is in it.
That's an analogy that makes me really hungry. But no, I mean, that's an interesting way of looking at it, and I don't think you're off there.
Here you go. No drum fills.
Yeah.
No orchestras.
Yep.
No backup singing, really, a little. What's this now?
No, you're right. There was no wall of sound going on. It was just a wall of guitars and a wall of screeching. But
it's the
melodic.
Bass,
I mean, it was still poppy.
True.
I mean, that outro guitar breakdown was just, that solo was just, good grief, it was so good. I'd forgotten how good it was.
He's a tasteful player, and the way he,
yes,
his antics.
Well, that's true. The stage show, those guys are just 100% energy, raw animal energy.
So he's got the schoolboy outfit.
And they got the hats.
And he rolls around on the ground like a kid throwing a tantrum.
In his shorts.
In his shorts.
Yeah.
And it all feels out of control, but yet the what's coming out of his guitar is very in control, very tasteful, very nice.
Wow. Yeah, this is all ringing very true.
Well, what I noticed when my kids were young, they would be in their car seats or whatever, and maybe a commercial with an AC/DC song would come on, or an AC/DC song would come on the radio, and they would immediately start like bobbing their heads, and they would kind of come alive and focus more on the music than, you know, whatever.
Than what you're saying to them. Huh? Than what you were saying to them.
Yeah, well, yeah, than what I was saying to them.
You guys calm down.
But
dirty deeds. Yeah.
It just showed me that that music comes through, it gets through to people. Yeah. No matter what you're doing, you turn and look when you hear AC/DC. Your ears perk up, you know.
Years ago, an old friend of mine told me about a band. And he said, I think you would like this band. And he said, they're called Green Day.
Right.
And he said,
I think I've heard of them.
He said, they sound like a little bit like the Ramones. He said, or maybe AC/DC. And I went and bought Green Day's Kerplunk album. This was right before Dookie came out.
Right. So you were in early, in other words.
I'm like, that sounds like the Ramones. I don't know where he got AC/DC. And then Dookie came out. I'm like, okay, now I think I see where he got AC/DC. You know, because I remember seeing the video for TNT, which hadn't released anything for a while. And they released that. And like, it was like Harold and I were our friend, mutual friend Harold, whose name comes up often in this.
It'll probably come up every other episode. Yeah.
And we were watching it on MTV or Night Tracks or something. And and Harold was like, that's kind of a cool song. I was like, it is kind of a cool song.
Yeah.
And it was like Green Day kind of power pop before Green Day existed. You know, so
it's some kind of thing.
There's a long reach there from AC/DC to other rock and roll.
Totally. But I think Mutt Lange is very involved in that. Like, you know, he went on to produce Pyromania and those Def Leppard albums.
As you've pointed out, you can like lay a Def Leppard album over a
Shania Twain
album, and they sound exactly the same.
I believe they do. It's kind of like Mutt has a big influence in the studio. Yeah. They recorded this album and this track in the Bahamas. There were crabs walking across the floor when they were playing the songs, thunderstorms, sort of hurricane force winds. It kind of all fit, you know, kind of like the brew that was making this. Of course, the wake of Bond's death, you know, hanging over the whole proceedings. But
we should record our next album in the Bahamas.
Man, I'd love to go down there. Can you imagine sitting on the beach during the day and recording by night?
Are we gonna say Bon Scott, or are we gonna say Brian Johnson? We don't have to decide.
Oh,
but
you mean as far as
do we have to decide? Is there a decision to be made? Or
here's what I'm gonna say: there is no decision has to be made. You can enjoy both. I mean, I think Bon's earnesty and you know, his honesty and vigor that they made those early albums with, and his kind of sort of bad boy trickster kind of feel is so great. And then Brian's sort of supercharged, throwing a lot of you know, kind of broad brushstroke lyrics at you that kind of, you can just, you know, kind of just get a feeling for Rolling Thunder, Pouring Rain, that kind of stuff, you know. Just, I mean, I think there's good with both guys. Brian Johnson seems like a totally great human being. If you consider all these guys are millionaires and they still wear jean jackets, right, and
goofy hats and still go up on stage and just,
well, they rock your socks off, but they don't look like the guys that are in Lear jets or have a butler. You know, they may well. They got the money for it, but
so kind of one of the things that I wanted to wrap up was sort of what Gallucci said, and I really was intrigued by what he wrote. But he said, Bon Scott was like, he was like the rock and roll star who just burned out. He was just so into it, the rock and roll lifestyle, that he burned out. He said that he feels like Brian Johnson was more like in on the joke. Mm. He's up there singing and playing and doing his motions and his cool, you know, and he's kind of like winking at the audience, and he's writing these lyrics, these cool toss-off lyrics. He said, but he thinks that he was more in on the joke, and that's part of why they've lasted longer than he thinks they would have with Bon at the helm.
I think that's pretty darn insightful.
I think it's an interesting insight. I really do. And I don't, again, it's just one man's opinion, but what he wrote was really, really impressive and really insightful. And again, this is a guy who's been writing about pop culture for years and years. So I don't know. That was just something.
So maybe it's a story of a band built, you know, like we went in the Jump episode on Van Halen. We talked about the tale of two bands.
Jump.
Yeah. I very much appreciate that. But anyway, it's like a band that was built to burn with Bon, burn so brightly and so out of control,
like a comet out of control, and then
and that's got to crash and burn, and then they built a better foundation with Brian
and became a star. Yeah,
maybe got a little more solid guy, but boy was he ready to take over.
Yeah,
it's remarkable the lyrics he wrote.
And the guy who was working on Cars.
I love those stories. Like you mentioned, crazy. Lou Gramm earlier, he was a janitor at a high school and got called into a Foreigner audition. So here's a guy working on Cars, living in his parents' house, 32, feeling washed up, and he look at his life.
Rock star immediately. Yeah.
Yeah. Geez.
All right. Beautiful. So I think we've gotten to the point that now I can talk about the thing that I've been dying to talk about.
Okay, let's go.
Are you ready to get there? Jim Brewer?
Sure, man. Yes.
I mean, have you said all you got to say about this topic?
I've got a little thing I'd like to what I'd like to say is AC/DC's music would work on lab animals. Like it would make them more productive, you know. Kurt Cobain said he got his first guitar when he was 14. For his birthday, and the first song he learned how to play was Back in Black.
I had that in my notes too.
Yeah. So my closing is that there's the music business and there's the AC/DC business.
Oh, interesting.
AC/DC does not conform to the rock and roll industry or the music business. They just do their thing, and they are their own house.
I think that's also insightful. I mean, because when we kick this off, it's like, this has never happened before in history, is that a band continues its legacy the way that they have. You know, I still say Van Hagar didn't do it. It was different. You know. But
yeah, it is different. Yeah, but it's very different.
So anyway, that's a great point. That's a great point. And I think that we can all agree on that, whether it's Bon Scott or Brian Johnson. So anyway, but no, Jim Brewer, a lot of folks have seen this, and I hadn't seen it until recently. But Jim Brewer can do Brian Johnson's vocals to perfection. It's ridiculous. And of course, he was an SNL cast member for a while, a touring comedian. And you've got to look up Jim Brewer doing AC/DC's version of the Hokey Pokey. It's incredible. And I've watched it over and over the last week and a half. I can't get enough of it.
So the premise is you plug in any lyrics,
song, anything, any lyrics, and AC/DC will rock it, will kill it. And so he just, it's so funny and so spot on, and his vocals are so great. And there's a video of they brought Brian Johnson in with Jim Brewer's band and did a version of a Rock and Roll Is Not Noise Pollution together, both of them singing it. So it's worth watching.
Rock and Roll Ain't Noise Pollution is a beautiful, what a sentiment. That's a great rock anthem.
And if you're listening to this on Podbean, just scroll down in the show notes, and I've put a link in there. And if you're listening on Spotify or some other platform, then just go to YouTube and type in AC/DC Hokey Pokey, and you'll find it.
You'll find that like strapping any household item to a rocket is what he's doing.
Basically, yes.
But if you are listening, we totally appreciate it.
We're, we do. And yeah. We're planning on at some point, if people still respond, where things seem to be going well, and we're going to eventually establish a Patreon so that we will want to take requests, and we would love to interact with you guys more if you're listening and want to have some input in the show.
I think it's good to have goals, you know what I mean?
I've got a goal to drink more beer when we're done.
Well, I think that's a great goal.
I think that's a great sign-off. All right.
Absolutely.
Cheers, Butch.
To AC/DC, to Bon Scott.
To Bon and Brian Johnson.
Long live the king.
See you next time, guys.
It's like when a goldfish dies and the parents replace the goldfish with one that looks kind of, you know, pretty much similar and hopes they don't notice.
And the kid's like, hey, that's not my fish.
No, they don't know.
My parents did that to me.
did they really?
Yep. I lived a sitcom.